Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Well, the Bakken Pipeline has been in the news, and the struggle continues up in North Dakota, where the Standing Rock Sioux and their allies from Native American tribes and white folks are defending the Missouri River from the earth-moving equipment of the Dakota Access Pipeline Building Company. Down here in Iowa, we have an encampment along the Des Moines River. I've invited into the studio Carolyn Raffensperger. Carolyn has been very instrumental in the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline. She is the director of Science, Health, and Environment Network, which is the sponsoring organization of the Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition. As a lawyer, she issued a brief on behalf of future generations to the Iowa Utilities Board at administrative hearing in November. And she has also been up to North Dakota and been with the folks there. Later in the show, we'll be joined by April Birch. She was just up in North Dakota at the Sacred Stone Camp this weekend, delivering supplies, and she'll tell about her experience up there. I invited Carolyn in because it really is crunch time as far as the pipeline goes, from what I understand, and she's going to tell us more about that. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Whoops. Let's turn your microphone up.
Well, I can say it again, how wonderful it is to be here and to see you again.
Yeah.
Thank you for the coverage that you've given to the struggle against this particular pipeline.
Well, let's start with this particular pipeline. I mean, we've heard in the national news, it seemed like every day or every week there were very large stories about the Keystone XL pipeline, a long pipeline down the middle of the country. It didn't happen to hit Iowa, but that one was vetoed by President Obama, and after, you know, quite a bit of discussion. What is it about the Bakken pipeline that hasn't gained that kind of media coverage?
That's a wonderful question. And Keystone had a very unique feature. As it was planned and designed, it covered the central part of the United States and ran from North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and on down south. But the really unique thing about Keystone was that it also went over the Canadian border. And because the whole pipeline was a cross-border and an international pipeline, then it required the United States State Department to actually give approval or disapproval of the pipeline. So we had one agency that we could focus on with Keystone. So the Bakken Pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is also now partially owned by Enbridge and Marathon Oil and a number of other companies, was designed to go right up to the North Dakota border and then down to Texas. But it was segmented. So it was planned out in pieces that would all connect. And there is, in fact, a very tiny piece of the pipeline that will now go over the border into Canada, and only that little section will require the State Department's approval. The rest of it, you know, begins in Illinois and ends in Texas, where it can be exported to other countries. The Dakota Access part of it goes to Patoka, Illinois, and to North Dakota, but it will have connections all the way up into Canada and down to the Gulf of Mexico. So what happened with that, and what's so peculiar, is that there are many, many, many agencies that had to give permits. The major decision-making bodies are actually the four states that this segment of the pipeline cover: North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois. So in Iowa, the Iowa Utilities Board granted permission for the entire length of the pipeline in Iowa, and then the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, the North Dakota Public Utilities Commission, and the Illinois Department of Commerce Commission. So what you have is this broken-up decision-making process with multiple federal agencies, multiple state agencies, and multiple county decision-making authorities. So in Story County had to make a decision about whether the pipeline could cross the drainage districts and the county roads. You go all the way up to the federal level, and then you've got multiple agencies from the Federal Energy and Regulatory Commission, the Department of Transportation. You've got U.S. Fish and Wildlife. You've got the Army Corps of Engineers. And we could go on and on and on, which made it much more difficult to resist because there wasn't one entity like the State Department with the Keystone Pipeline.
Wow. So a real fragmentation of focus and power and control.
Exactly.
And it sounds like, it seems like there was a lot of kind of passing the buck maybe of authority. I know that in some counties, you know, the county might say, we can't do anything about this as our, you know, the drainage, we have control over the drainage districts, but, you know, we can't really weigh in on the overall Iowa scheme.
Exactly. I say exactly twice in a row, but you've hit it spot on. So what happened in some of the counties, Boone County, for instance, they passed a resolution objecting to the pipeline for a couple of reasons. One was that they didn't have enough emergency responders. They didn't have trained emergency responders in case of a major problem. And then they wanted to delay the permit until all the permits were in. They wanted to delay the permits to cross the drainage districts since it involves water. And basically, Dakota Access advised them that if they did not give the permit, that they could be sued. And then there were some other overlapping legal considerations. There's this doctrine called preemption, which is if the federal government has made a law about something, that preempts the state's ability to regulate or make laws about it. And if a state has made a law about something, that limits how a county can do it. That idea of preemption said that if the Iowa Utilities Board had passed the rules and gave the permit, it was very difficult for the counties to resist, even though they had authority over the drainage districts. It's a mess. And I think what it shows is that that we are on completely new territory now with these extreme energy sources. So the oil coming through this pipeline is fracked oil. A new technology in the last 10 years where they're able to get oil from very, very deep in the ground by injecting sand and other things to kind of force the rock open and then the gas flows up. Those are evolving technologies, newer technologies. So we're able to get oil and gas from under very extreme conditions. And now the only way to get those to market, we've had railroads and we've had trucking, but now they're trying to put pipelines literally across the country. But the crude oil pipelines have such this disjointed, fragmented, segmented kind of permitting authority that it's basically a failed process.
Let's talk about the IUB. We've mentioned the Iowa Utilities Board. Just what is that?
The Iowa Utilities Board is an administrative agency, so it's part of the governor's, under the executive branch. The governor appoints three members of the Iowa Utilities Board to make decisions about utilities. So they approve wind energy projects. They have oversight over many of the energy issues in the state. None of them are elected. Two of them have to be the same party as the governor, so two are Republicans right now and one is a Democrat. And they unanimously agreed to give Dakota Access a permit. There were many, many hearings, days of hearings, days and days and days of hearings, and my organization intervened on behalf of future generations. So the Science and Environmental Health Network was literally there as the voice of future generations. Now, the reason that we did that is because most of the arguments for Dakota Access's, private crude oil pipeline carrying oil through Iowa was a very short-term set of benefits that accrue to present generations. Almost all the costs, whether it's water pollution or climate change, all accrue to future generations. And so we felt that the voice of, you know, the second, the fourth, the seventh generation needed to be present in those proceedings. And so we became that. Now, there were other organizations that intervened on for environmental reasons. The Sierra Club of Iowa intervened on for environmental reasons. We had another organization, No Bakken Here, that intervened because of climate and the impact, the implications of the pipeline for climate.
That concept of future generations is very tied in with Native American spirituality, the concept of the seventh generation. You don't do anything that would impact the seventh generation negatively. Well, it looks like this might possibly impact the first generation negatively, or even sooner than that, if the pipeline breaks. And what is the prospect of a pipeline break?
You know, if there was a parable about this, and it would end with the tagline, not when, if. And I think that I'm at least tired of saying it. But, you know, pipelines break. Here in Ames, we had a water main break 2 weeks ago. And why should we be surprised when they break and when they leak? This crosses so many waterways, including the Des Moines River, where we've set up a camp and where we've been actively monitoring construction. It was near the Des Moines River that we set up the blockade, and where there were 30 arrests, many of them from Ames, because we were standing for the concept that water is life. A lot of people say, well, we need oil, and it's all pervasive in our Western way of life. Oil is, but that doesn't mean that it is good for us or that there aren't alternatives. And the larger idea is we can do without oil. We cannot live without water. The indigenous community that has taken an extraordinarily active defense of water in Standing Rock, North Dakota, say water is life. And I think that the two phrases that you hear over and over again in this struggle is that water is life, and that we do this for future generations.
I'm talking with Carolyn Raffensperger. She is the director of Science and Environmental Health Network, an organization that this seems like right up your alley. You've got the environment, you've got health.
Exactly.
And you're bringing people together in the network, the Balkan Pipeline Resistance Coalition, helping people's voices be heard. How many signatures were on that petition to the Army Corps of Engineers? Was that the destination, or was it the IUB?
Well, there have been a bunch of petitions. One petition is to President Obama, and the reason is that there are still two outstanding permits right now. One is a permit that is actually an easement, and that's up on the Missouri River. That's what's called a Section 408 permit, and it's what's being contested by the Standing Rock Sioux right now. They have a lawsuit trying to stop construction, and the fact is that the Army Corps of Engineers gave something called the Nationwide Permit, which allowed the construction under and through so many of the rivers, including the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Des Moines, the Big Sioux, many of the rivers in the Midwest. And so the Army Corps of Engineers is under the Commander-in-Chief, President Obama. And so this one permit that's not been granted yet is an easement across a dammed lake called Lake Oahe, which was part of the Missouri River. So they're waiting to give that. And so we're contesting the grant of the nationwide permit that applies to Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Illinois. And we are trying to block the 408 permit across Lake Oahe. But there's another permit which is also important, and important here in Iowa as well as North and South Dakota and Illinois, and that is the hydrostatic testing permit. So all of these big words that most of us aren't accustomed to dealing with in our daily life. And what a hydrostatic testing permit is when they take water from one water body. So imagine that they take it from Lake Oahe, and they shoot it through the pipeline some distance, and then they discharge the water into another water body. So they could discharge it into the Mississippi River. Now why would they do that? Well, the hydrostatic test is to shoot water through to test the pipeline for failure. You know, are all of the welds solid? Are there pinpoint leaks that are leaking water? But it takes a vast amount of water that they're going to move very quickly through that pipe, and then they're going to dump it somewhere else. Now, in Iowa, we know that we've got problems with non-native species. We know that we're concerned about zebra mussels. We've got concerns about all sorts of things that are making a mess out of our already polluted and damaged waterways. People are told to clean their boats before you take them to another water body, and yet we're going to allow a pipeline company to take our water, and use it to test their pipeline and then just dump it like it was trash in another river or another lake. And that permit should be denied. Iowa has delegated authority from the federal government to give that permit. So Iowa Department of Natural Resources has the delegated authority under the Clean Water Act. But President Obama's agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, has overall authority for that permit. So we want that permit to be denied. We do not want them to be taking the waters of the people of Iowa and the United States and using them for this purpose and contaminating, using, you know, cross-contamination of the water, the threat around non-native species that can do damage, et cetera.
So the there is a part of this long pipeline that has not been granted the right to be there yet. It's still being contested, this 408 permit. And yet the pipeline's being laid, right? There's a lot of pipe in the ground. I've seen it south of here, going towards Slater and so on. I mean, they're not waiting for these permits to be granted.
The one permit on Lake Oahe, so there's a couple of things that are holding this up. One is the lawsuit that the tribes brought against the Army Corps of Engineers for that nationwide permit that covers all four states. The only thing blocking it right now on Lake Oahe is this additional permit called the 408 permit. So that's a very tiny segment of land, but it could hold things up. The other thing that's not holding it up but could end up being a fly in their ointment is that there are a number of lawsuits that have been consolidated in Iowa. So the Sierra Club brought an environmental lawsuit here, and landowners brought a lawsuit on eminent domain, challenging the Iowa Utilities Board's grant of eminent domain over their land. And those have been consolidated in the state court. So there's still things that could stop this or delay it. And if it's delayed, then Dakota Access could run out of money. They borrowed so much money for this project. They are in over their heads. And as you know, oil prices are down really low. You can fill up your tank for about half of what you could fill it up with, what, 3-4 years ago. So the finances of this are getting sticky. The other thing is that their permit to construct this has a limited time frame. They have talked about they may run out of time, and I hope they do.
And that's obviously the focus of the groups that are resisting the pipeline, is to just, it's kind of a rope-a-dope. Let's just touch on that, the one legal point, for those who haven't been paying as close attention as you have and I have. The issue of eminent domain seems mm-hmm. to be the centerpiece of these lawsuits of landowners. Can you explain sort of what the argument for the plaintiffs is in those cases?
Yes. So it's a longstanding practice. It's, you know, legal. There are mechanisms for it in the Constitution. That you can take someone's private land if it's for a public necessity, for a public benefit, for public use. There are many different words depending on what state you're in. And in Iowa, you can take it for a public utility. You can take it for a road, you know, a public road. There are lots of things that you can take someone's property for through eminent, this thing called eminent domain. The land is seized. It's actually, the words are condemned. And then the landowner has to be paid a fair market value for it. And what's contested is that there is no real utility to Iowans for the Dakota Access Pipeline, and that there's a clause in Iowa law that says you can't take farmland for that. So they're suing for both of those. Now, the legal kind of machinations and twists and turns to try and squeeze the notion of utility, a utility into the Dakota Access Pipeline is watching, you know, kind of a lawyer's sleight of hand. And I think that that's what we've seen, essentially a sleight of hand on this. There is no way to really make this a utility.
A utility would be something like a service line to your house or
right.
to that a main, like a water main,
yeah.
something that delivers a necessary
good or services to you. So whether it's the electric lines, whether it's the water main, things like that are utilities. A crude oil pipeline that has no start or stop in Iowa cannot in any one's mind be construed to be a utility. But they have tried to pull that legal, you know, sleight of hand, that trick, that magic trick to make
and
it so.
A lot of the signs that I saw at the protest near the Farm Progress show where people were arrested, the signs were saying no eminent domain for private gain.
Exactly. So the idea of eminent domain goes to a theory of government. You know, if government's main responsibility is to grow the economy, then you're going to argue that this is a utility. You know, and if all of you're concerned about is getting, you know, a couple of corporations rich, then you're going to say, sure, take that person's private land. They're not making enough money for either the state of Iowa or a corporation. But if your theory of government is that it's to take care of the things that we share, drinking water, roads, schools, clean air, wildlife, then you have a very different idea of what you would use eminent domain for. So in my theory of government, which is a basic Midwestern principle, we take care of the things we share, then you only use eminent domain to add to the common wealth, the common health. And what they have done is they've stolen private property, given to a private corporation, and all it's going to do is damage the commons. It's only going to damage public health. It's only going to damage the public good.
Okay. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'd like to hear about that other side that you want to talk about, and we'll also talk about your time up in North Dakota where the Standing Rock Sioux have gathered many nations to protest the use of their land for this purpose.
Hey, Lama, Elohe, we chose Ali Wama, Yaku, Elohe, Hey, Lama, Elohe, Hey, Lama, Elohe.
We're back on Local Talk, KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. We're talking about the Bakken Pipeline that is planned to go from North Dakota south and then diagonal across the state of Iowa, a 30-inch pipe that will be under almost 1,500 pounds per square inch of pressure, pushing crude oil from the Bakken oil fields south and east to a distribution point in Patoka, Illinois. Carolyn Raffensperger is the director of Science and Environmental Health Network, and that organization is the sponsoring organization for Bakken Pipeline Resistance Coalition. Now, Carolyn, you have been up several times to the site up in North Dakota where the Standing Rock Sioux have staged the most impressive resistance to this pipeline that we've seen. And in fact, it's gained national attention. Some 4,000 people are there now. Tell us about the evolution of that resistance effort up there.
So in March, I was invited by the wonderful activist Joy Braun who had been part of the Keystone Resistance, to come to a meeting of the Sioux Grandfathers. And they were organizing a meeting around the pipeline, and they just invited me to come. Now, I had been helping to convene a regional group of activists from Illinois, Iowa, South Dakota, and North Dakota to kind of address this in a similar way, make similar demands across the utilities commissions and et cetera. So I went up there in March to be part of this fabulous meeting. I met many of the activists. So LaDonna Allard and Joy Braun, others were there. And very soon after that March meeting in April, they created the Sacred Stone Camp. And they camped out by the side of the Missouri River and had pledged their resistance to the pipeline. They put out a call for supplies, and I went up there, and either April or May, I don't remember now, it was still pretty cold because they had called for boats. And I took a kayak, a yellow kayak that I had gotten here at a garage sale in Ames. So if you're listening to this and it was your boat, you should know that it's part of that resistance up there. And then I've been part of the legal team for over 2 years. And I went up a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, to help coordinate the on-the-ground legal team there. And so I was present at the camp when Homeland Security removed the water, the hand-washing facilities, and all of those other things. I was I helped to draft the international call for observers. And we had Amnesty International come in very quickly. The United Nations have came in response to that. I was so glad to have the background over the last couple of years with the legal issues around the pipeline because I could help translate those. But even better, I knew the activists and had close personal relationships with the Indigenous Environmental Network and others through the years that we've been working on both the pipeline and before that. And I want to give a shout-out to my friends at the Indigenous Environmental Network, Candy Mossett and Dallas Goldtooth and Tom Goldtooth, former employees, Bob Schimmick, because they're the ones who told me that some of the work that I was doing on a concept called the precautionary principle was actually the concept that many Indigenous nations, and specifically some in the East, the Iroquois Confederacy, have around the seventh generation idea, which you referenced earlier. And they said that this idea of taking action to prevent harm in the future was the seventh generation decision rule. And so I've been working with them for a long time, and it led to this intervention on behalf of future generations in this pipeline.
Oh, really? So the essence of your testimony at the IUB trial, it wasn't an official trial, but an administrative hearing, that came from your experience working with these activists.
It was. And it was out of some of the work that we had done with the Indigenous Environmental Network trying to stop something called the Pebble Mine, a big, vast gold mine in Alaska that led to a partnership with Harvard Law School Center for International Human Rights, where we drafted the basic framework for asserting the rights of future generations. So we have a constitutional provision. We did a statute. We have executive orders, many things. But then to put it into play on the ground for something like this pipeline was deeply meaningful. Now, a lot of the work that I did had not a lot to do with that, you know, advising protesters in the moment, you know, should we do this, should we do that, was exhilarating and seems tangential to some of the other work that I had done, but it wasn't. It gave me as a lawyer an opportunity to operate out of that moral ground. You know, I've said in several places, based on a dream that I had, that the Tree of Life holds the scales of justice. In our country, our Western idea of the law, our scales of justice hanging from a blindfolded woman. And I don't believe that it's the blindfolded woman. I believe that it is the Tree of Life, that is nourished by these rivers that we're trying to protect. And that as a lawyer, my job is twofold. One is to guarantee the justice of that that is represented by the tree of life holding the scales of justice. And the other responsibility I have is to be the guardian of the guardians. So those folks who are standing in defense of water, saying water is life, the ones who are standing for future generations, then my job as a lawyer was to defend them, to be the guardian of them, to use the law and prevent the law from harming the guardians and harming the tree of life. And it's not something that you're taught in law school. I can tell you that.
Oh, my goodness. So just this idea that Homeland Security went in and took away the water, mm-hmm. and took away the hand-washing facilities, exactly what does that mean? There was a faucet that they turned off. What was this?
The North Dakota Department of Public Health, I think it's the Public Health, had provided big buffaloes of drinking water. They had hand-washing stations. They had emergency vehicles like ambulances, and they had a mobile little clinic kind of thing. And Homeland Security insisted that they be removed because the group was unruly. Well, I was there, and it was a peaceful, sunny day. There were children playing. There were drumming and singing. We were going on with business as usual, life in the camps. And all of a sudden, someone came running to me and told me that two things. One is that the governor had authorized force, the use of force. And the second was that they were removing the basic infrastructure for health in the camps. You don't have much health if you've taken away the drinking water and if you've taken away hand washing. All of a sudden you can get infectious diseases that will run through the camp. You know, you'll have foodborne illnesses, waterborne illnesses. You will have just all the things that come from crowding and a lack of sanitation. And I was frantic. Now, we had to work through the rumors, because rumors can go through both sides quite rapidly. And you'll see some of those promulgated and promoted in the media. So what I had to sort out was the authorization of force. Well, the governor can authorize force at any moment. There's no special authorization. That was probably somebody who had infiltrated and just said that. But in the meantime, we did not know if they were going to be calling out the National Guard and invading this camp full of women and children. So one of the other members of the legal team immediately was asked to draft and carry out an evacuation of women and children across the river. And at the same time, I'm trying to stop the removal of that water and hand washing. It was chaotic. And in that moment, to sort fact from fiction, to act, keep the women and children safe, to protect the public health of the camp. So, you know, those are, again, not things they train you to do in law school. They did remove all of the infrastructure. And you know what happened? All of the tribes gathered together, and in less than 18 hours, we had what we needed. We didn't have a beautiful mobile unit for public health, you know, for the clinic. We had a tent with a cot in it. But we had the Standing Rock ambulance. We had all of those emergency responders who were ready to act under extraordinarily difficult and primitive conditions. So not only the lawyers were doing emergency law, but those emergency health responders were operating in what looked like a MASH, referencing the TV show.
Yeah.
Kind of conditions. So all of us were doing our best to create a security team, medics, public health, legal structures. It was an amazing thing. But the tribes came through and were able to, it looks like a refugee camp, but it's not. This is the most peaceful encampment. It is safe for women and children. It is safe for, the horses. It is safe for future generations. The only thing that makes it unsafe is North Dakota's law enforcement, the Morton County sheriff, and others, and then the private security. So just the other day, I can't even remember what day it was, over the weekend, the tribe was invited to go on private land and survey for cultural sites. And they went on, and Friday they filed an affidavit with the court. And Saturday, I believe it was Saturday, Dakota Access jumped over from where they had been, and they bulldozed them through. They just bulldozed those sites. And people found the bulldozers and desecrating the burials and the sacred sites, the active cultural sites where prayers were undertaken and other things. And they stormed the private security and the bulldozers. About 1,000 people, it appears, stormed them. The private security brought out dogs that attacked and bit the people who were trying to defend water and their sacred sites. It was one of the most horrific things I've ever seen. It was awful.
Okay. We have, I want to talk about this whole concept, how culturally skewed the notion of not only unruly and lawlessness are the words that continue to be used, but I also want to bring April Birch into the conversation. April was just up there this weekend delivering supplies, I understand. Is that right, April?
Thank you, Greta, yes. We arrived late on Friday night, and we were actually at the main camp on Saturday as people were heading up to the site where private security attacked the water defenders. I was with my family, and I can attest to what Carolyn had said. It is a beautiful place. The larger camp, the Red Warrior camp, when we were there on Saturday, it had swelled to about 4,000 people, I believe. And many, many women and children and elders, and it has almost a festival atmosphere. People are enjoying each other's company. People are making friends. As the water defenders were headed up to the construction site, up to the blockade, we had just finished unloading our trailer of donations from the good people of Central Iowa, and we had decided to go back to Sacred Stone where we were camped to eat some lunch, and then we were going to come back and watch horsemanship activities that were happening that afternoon. And so we watched as the groups assembled and started walking towards the site. And it was a large group with people of all ages, women, children, elders, young men, young women, happily walking towards the blockade. And we never would have suspected the terror that they were about to meet on the site. And when we returned to the camp for the horsemanship events, we started hearing what had gone on. And I had heard that rumors spread like wildfire through the camps. And so I kept asking, what did happen? What happened? And as the day went on, the stories became very clear as to what had happened. People were attacked. Viciously attacked in what is an ongoing cultural genocide in the United States of America. It is horrifying that people are not allowed to protect sacred sites. They did everything that they could possibly do to protect these sites, including filing legal paperwork the day before, and still Dakota Access acts with impunity at this point in time. It is outrageous that they are still allowed to proceed with construction. So I've seen some of the videos, and it's incredibly upsetting. You see a woman and her young son walking up to the security contractors, trying to talk to him, trying to reason with him, and he's blocking. And eventually she steps around him, and other women step around him as well, and they move towards the bulldozers that are moving as quickly as they can to tear up that land. And the women step out, and the bulldozers stop. And that's really what I saw on many of the videos that had come out since.
And the women stepped in front of the bulldozers And then the dogs were unleashed?
I'm not exactly sure.
I don't know the timing on it, but they brought the dogs out of their trucks, and they were on leashes, and then one person unleashed her dog. Hard to know whether it unleashed it or got free. But there were several people that were bitten that required medical attention, and one of the dogs turned on its handler. So, you know, the thing about using a dog like that is that dogs are the only species that love humans without reserve. It's the only species. You know, your cat doesn't love humanity. you know, the zebras don't. But the dogs have been humanity's friend for a very long time, and they weaponized those dogs. They weaponized those dogs. That is, and they turned them on people, in a tactic that has been used against civil and human rights for a long time. So there are many pictures of the dogs being unleashed in Birmingham, 1963, and now Standing Rock in 2016. So using dogs, and some of the National Lawyers Guild lawyers have said that they can even put metal teeth on the dogs that make them sharper and more, can do more damage. So what we have done in weaponizing this, a dog, and then turning them loose on women and children and unspeakable.
April, maybe you can talk about what you brought up to folks up there, a little bit of good news.
Sure. Well, we had watched all of the supply lists come out over the previous week and a half, and we tried to target things that would work well for us. We took a 6x12 trailer, and we carried hundreds of pounds, probably close to 500 pounds of non-perishable foods. We carried a box full of solar showers. We carried solar panels of a couple of different varieties. We also purchased a few hundred dollars in fresh produce from the Boone Farmers Market the night before we left, and were able to deliver fresh produce. We had one family donate 50 pounds of frozen beef. They had purchased half a cow the year before and weren't able to finish it off. So they sent us with 50 pounds of frozen beef. We took bedding. We took warm clothes. People are getting ready to tighten up camp and settle in for the winter here shortly. So that was one of the things that we were asked to bring. We took antacid medication, a wide variety of things, batteries. All of these things are much appreciated and needed. And we also received a large donation from a company called Clean Canteen out of Chico, California. The owners, the founders of Clean Canteen were friends of mine, and we served in AmeriCorps together in Northern California in the Watershed Stewards Project. And they were able to donate, I think it was 7 cases of stainless steel water bottles and cups. So that was much appreciated to reduce disposables at the camp.
Real quick, if folks want to contribute to this cause, where is there an organization that they can go to?
There are a number of organizations right now. They're one of the most active fundraising vehicles is the GoFundMe site for Sacred Stone Camp. You can go to GoFundMe.com and just search for Sacred Stone, and you'll find the GoFundMe page right there. And there are literally dozens of local groups that are organizing GoFundMe pages to raise funds to purchase supplies and take them to Sacred Stone and Red Warrior camps.
Okay. Carolyn?
April is exactly right on that. Sacred Stones is a good place to donate. And if you're interested in some of the NGOs that are involved, the Indigenous Environmental Network has had a big presence on the ground, and then the Back and Pipeline Resistance Coalition here in Iowa, and you can find that, and the Science and Environmental Health Network is the sponsoring organization. So you have some choices for those donations.
So there's 4,000 people up there in North Dakota camping out, and there are a couple dozen, three dozen maybe, folks up on the Des Moines River near Pilot Mound camping out. Let's real quickly compare these two struggles, these two focus of groups.
Well, we've been calling the little encampment near Norton's Ford and near Pilot Mound the Sacred Stones Annex. And the interesting thing about that camp is that it's just like the Missouri River struggle, in that we're trying to protect the Des Moines River. And it is right near the construction on private land that was seized through eminent domain. And you can go there. You can stand in the road. We're looking at, they're looking at doing the construction under the Des Moines River any day now. So.
Any day now.
Yep. So, it's part of why the encampment is there. It's to bear witness. It is to bear witness to what the land is going through. It is to bear witness to what we are doing to our farmland. It is to do what we can to, slow this down. We created a really interesting project across the states, which are pipeline monitors, so that you can observe violations of the rules and the laws, and you can report them. So there's a Facebook page called the DAPL, DA for Dakota Access Pipeline, DAPL, Pipeline Construction Watchdogs. I posted the handbook this morning there. You can get all the information for where the camp is, and you can come out and you can participate in monitoring the construction. If there are opportunities for direct action, you can be part of that. You can financially support that. There are lots of ways to join in this.
Our kids are very excited to go out to Sacred Stone Annex. They look forward to comparing the different camps. When we got home last night at about 10:30 after a 13-hour drive with the kids, our 4-year-old said, "We go camping tonight?" So they're really looking forward to going out and seeing it. They loved being at the camp. We talked this morning quite a bit about what their favorite part of being up in North Dakota was, being at the camps, and they all said the river. They loved swimming in the Cannonball River right there at the Red Warrior Camp, and they loved playing with all of the kids that were up there. I mean, there were literally hundreds of children playing in the river on Saturday night. It was a delight.
I want to honor April for the work that she's done over this time. And I heard that she almost sent out a May Day because she had to load all of those supplies. And so there are things that people don't tell you about those who've been engaged in the struggle for a long time and what's actually required to help and participate for those who have been extremely active over a long time. And April's one of them.
Thank you, Carolyn.
I just think it's such a beautiful discovery of a different way of being that we see in the camp that you've described, in the camp that it has been called lawlessness, has been called unruliness, and yet this is sort of bringing back the tradition of the summer camps that Native Americans used to go on. They used to take the whole tribe and go to a summer camp, and now they're doing it. They're leaving their government homes with their four walls and going back to teepees. It sounds wonderful.
I will say, though, that there's some consequences. I try to get all of my food, either we produce it, or I put it up from a few miles of my house. And I have to tell you that at being as involved in this as I've been, my larder is going to be pretty thin this winter.
I know. Our garden is just abysmal this year.
Well, you're going to have to go out and hunt some buffalo. Thank you so much, both of you, Carolyn Raffensperger and April Birch. It does sound like this is the time to get involved. If you out there have been thinking this is not something that you want, this pipeline in the ground, that there's really no other time than now to act. Am I right?
That's true. Now is the time. They are slamming that pipeline through the earth so fast. They will be up and running tomorrow. You can join the camp tomorrow morning. You can monitor the pipeline any day and report it on the DAPL Pipeline Construction Monitor site. It is happening right now, and there are volunteers and people who have been at this day and night in Iowa and North Dakota, South Dakota, and Illinois for months. Join them. They're tired. Tell them that they're doing a good job. You have no idea how many tears have been shed, how much hard work this has been. You have no idea. Come join us. We need your good cheer. We need your strength. We need to know that we're not alone.
And Wednesday is a rain, it's a 100% chance of rain. That means something special for pipeline drillers, I understand.
They are not allowed to do construction in a field if it's too wet for a farmer. So we plan on being out there to make sure that they do not do construction in the rain. We will not only protect the river, we will protect that soil.
Okay, once again, thank you, Carolyn Raffensperger. Thank you, April Birch, not only for joining me this afternoon, but also for all of that hard work you're doing, making it easy for other people to just pop in and do their little piece and participate and have their voices heard. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started this Labor Day show with a look at the minimum wage with information from the Iowa Policy Project in Iowa City. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with links relevant to today's stories, including those organizations referenced in the show. Local Talk was engineered today by myself, Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.